Well, I better find a job. Let's see, business section. Ooh, la, what do we got here? The mate ones, huh? Cute couple. Look nice and stupid, too.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of Beetlejuice.
Don't even say his name. You don't want his help.
Hosted by Stuart.
Live people ignore the strange and unusual. I myself am strange and unusual.
Jacob.
Yeah, what's really beautiful about this? You two kids picked me. You didn't have to, but you picked me. It makes me want to kiss you guys. Come on.
And Arnie.
He does not work well with others.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Go ahead. Make my millennium.
Listener discretion is advised.
Now, let's turn on the juice and see what shakes loose.
Today we're discussing Beetlejuice, starring Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis, Jeffrey Jones, Catherine O'Hara, Winona Ryder, and Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice, directed by Tim Burton. This is your Now Playing podcast host with the most, Arnie.
Stuart.
And this is Jacob, the host who's seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every time I see it.
I've seen Beetlejuice about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every time I see it. I think that as we do these 30th anniversaries of movies, we did our sci-fi of 86 and our horror of 86, and now we're doing the 30th anniversary of Beetlejuice. We should just call this Arnie is Frickin' Old series.
Yeah, you're saying 30th anniversary. I was 11 when this came out, and I went to an opening weekend. I remember seeing this film in theaters.
Did you see it in theaters, Stuart?
Nope.
Me either. I knew about this movie. I saw the trailers, and by the time it came out on video, I was so hyped for this and Heathers. I have those two movies indelibly linked in my mind. They came out on video about the same time, and they both have Winona Ryder. And I literally went to my video store and I sat there because they wouldn't hold movies when they came back. Although sometimes they would for me because I was a regular. But I went there and I just sat and watched whatever they had on their television until somebody returned Beetlejuice because I had to see Beetlejuice. And I went home and watched it.
I looked up when this was released because for some reason, my memory, I thought this was after 89 Batman, but this was 88. So it was before I got all hyped into Keaton because he played Batman. But it was March 30th it came out. So it must have been a spring break week because I was staying with my grandparents. My parents went on vacation by themselves, left the kids to be babysat. And remember, my grandma took us to this movie and then she would watch all those Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood or whatever they played back then 30 years ago. And this was getting hyped on those shows. Oh, this Michael Keaton is hilarious. And I remember seeing this film at 11 and just not getting it. But as the years have gone by and I've rewatched it, I really appreciate this film now.
Okay, so both of you have, I guess, would say grown up with this film. I saw this movie once. I rented it and I know I saw it and I probably enjoyed it. No memory other than Deo.
Oh, I didn't even have to watch this movie. I could have skipped the movie for this review. I know it so well.
Seriously, me too. I had a busy week. I had influenza, and I really thought, you know, I don't need to watch this movie, but I will because I love it.
You say Beetlejuice to me, I think of, you can laugh if you want, the cartoon.
Oh my God, I tried rewatching that insipid thing.
Oh, it's so bad. Yeah, me too.
Are you kidding? It really is?
Yeah.
Because that's, in my mind, having not revisited it, is the best Saturday morning cartoon ever made.
Oh, it's weird continuity wise if you want to get into that, and it's not good. You know, I watched this before with my girls and they like really liked it. I'm like, you know, guys, there's a cartoon. And they're like, oh, we gotta see it. So we went to YouTube and I'm like, oh boy, this was a mistake. This is like when I decided to show them Ewoks and that cartoon don't hold up.
Same film company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
the same studio that did Ewoks did the Beetlejuice stuff.
Oh, well, I was saying the same company that brought this movie, Burton co-produced that and would sometimes write ideas for that. And Larry Wilson, who co-wrote this Beetlejuice script, or at least a draft of it, also worked in that show. To me, when I think about things that were converted to Saturday morning cartoons, this was the best one because it got something right that the movie didn't for me. It made Lydia and Beetlejuice friends, and they worked together and they had adventures together. My memory of Beetlejuice was that the ads told you Keaton, 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 and then when he got there, it's Gina and Alec.
That was one of the confusing things when I was a kid. I thought this was all going to be about Michael Keaton, and he's the villain in it. He's not the main character.
Yeah, I mean, it's said in the credits, and Michael Keaton. He is the face of the movie. He is the titular character. He's not in it very much, but that didn't necessarily matter to me back then because I knew Gina Davis by this time from Fletch, The Fly, Transylvania 65,000. I'd seen all of those movies before I saw Beetlejuice. And Michael Keaton, Johnny Dangerously, of course, when I championed in our underrated movies book, I'd seen that. And I didn't really know him that much yet.
Come on, Mr. Mom. That's what I knew him from, is the Mr. Mom guy.
Yeah, and Gung Ho, which is terrible. Don't see it.
I didn't see either of those movies until the 90s, strangely.
Wow, okay.
I saw Gung Ho, the TV series spinoff, but I never saw Gung Ho, the movie.
It was better.
But Beetlejuice just had something about it. Now, I had seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure in theaters, but I didn't know who Tim Burton was. All I knew was that this movie had good buzz about it. Fangoria and Starlog were writing about it. People at school were talking about it, so I was anxious to see it, but I knew nothing about the creative forces behind it, and I didn't know who Alec Baldwin was either, and looking at this movie, it doesn't look like Alec. I can't tell it's Alec.
No, he's too skinny to play Trump.
Yeah, it's, again, you're catching everyone, I think, before they were somebody, other than Gina Davis, who is holding an Oscar at this point.
And Jeffrey Jones, who this is probably the height of his career.
Yes, true. Ferris Bueller was the height of his career, but yes, Jeffrey Jones and Gina are the exceptions. Everyone else is untested at this point. And I think if you came to this movie, they are there because Michael Keaton, wild and crazy guy who had been in so many comedies, was going to be in it. And then you find out he's really not in it. That was a jolting surprise for me and why I never really came back to it that often or ever until now.
And I remembered coming back. I watched this movie after I saw it the first time. I immediately recorded it and watched it regularly throughout high school, anytime it came on throughout college. But when I sat down to watch it this week, I could recite every line, but I couldn't tell you the last time I watched it. But my memories were very clear. I remembered every supernatural scene. I remembered all the various undead people that we meet. I remembered the house. I remembered the Dietzes. And so it was strange to me coming back to realize how little Keaton is in it, and yet how it's still so supernatural that this movie is quirky without him. And when he comes in, things just get turned up to 11.
I don't think it was always going to be that way. It wasn't always Keaton and it wasn't always Burton. And I did want to find out what this movie could have been like without them, because the imprint of both Keaton and Burton is so heavy in this. I mean, everything you associate with it is something that they brought to this project. What would it have been without him? I think it would have been a weird cross between Ghostbusters and Nightmare on Elm Street, because that's when the original drafts were written, and it was much more of a horror movie. I read the second draft, which sort of straddles the movie that we see here, but the character was small, Middle Eastern, and just, he would do a lot of dress up and drag and play different characters, but was not as zany as Keaton would play it, and it killed people.
The original concept was that it would be Sammy Davis Jr. as Beetlejuice.
That was Tim Burton's idea.
Yeah.
What? The Candyman?
Yeah, he wanted that. And you can kind of see when you see Nightmare Before Christmas, that Ooga Booga guy is probably what he wanted Beetlejuice to be.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and there was going to be murder. The very first draft is much, much darker. R-rated violence. And even the Maitlands themselves are darker, trying to torture the Dietzes instead of making them sing Calypso.
It was a bigger family, too. There were two daughters.
Yeah. The older one, though, didn't have much point.
No. Well, she was actually kind of goth, but just more she was rich, privileged, and goth was what was in. And then the little one was like a Carol Ann figure that, you know, was doing all the talking with the Maitlands.
Yeah, I had to research because I realized I still don't know a whole lot about Tim Burton, how he became Tim Burton. And I really think this movie did it. Reading up, just for anyone who didn't know like I didn't, he started off and his short film Frankenweenie got him hired at Disney, where he worked in the Disney production studios as a concept artist. He worked on films designing concepts that were never used for movies like Tron. And then he made another short and Disney fired him because it was too dark for kids. But out of Frankenweenie and everything, Paul Reubens saw it and said, I think this is the guy who should direct Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And so Paul Reubens handpicked Tim Burton to come in and rewrite Pee-wee and direct Pee-wee. And Pee-wee made a lot of money. And so Tim Burton had a number of offers coming his way. But if you'd asked me before prepping for this review, I would have said Beetlejuice was written and directed by Tim Burton. The fact that this was just a script that was floating around Hollywood, landed on his desk, and he saw something in it that he could use, I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, I think use is the right word, because this has Burton's fingerprints all over it. It would be hard for me to imagine what that original script, you guys have described it, but for what we get, it screams Tim Burton to me.
I can tell you what it read like to me. It read like a Chevy Chase vacation movie with ghosts. It was pretty dumb.
Like Ghost Dad? That didn't turn out well.
Yeah, maybe like Ghost Dad, or again, like a parody of Poltergeist or something. Modern Problems, if you ever saw that Chevy Chase movie where he gets psychic powers and Nell Carter shows up as a medium. It had that kind of zany National Lampoon quality to it, with a violence in the supernatural killing Freddy Krueger thing as well. So, yes, if it sounds bad, that's kind of how it read. And I do think that Burton was just at the point where, because we didn't know who he was, he could impress us all with just his style. What he brings to this movie is everything that we remember about it. You know, the waiting room scene and the idea of a bureaucratic afterlife and all of those characters, those creatures and the puppetry.
I mean, just the effects. Yeah, the sandworms, all that. I mean, it's, I don't want to say low budget, but it's all very, very stop motion practical, which I associate with Burton. That's part of his charm, that he's willing to just do those throwback things. Who cares what it looks like?
And it was actually fairly low budget. When he realized he was only being given $15 million, he specifically went, and he'd direct this movie later, for an Ed Wood feel. He did not want anything to even attempt photorealism, because it would fail. And so he decided to go stylized and obviously fake, and that works.
Yeah, that was part of the fun of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, is that Large Marge, you know, she was scary, but not like because she looked scary. It was just such a jolt to have that weird moment in what was a silly, supposedly a kid's home. I'm a huge fan of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And if you want to see what Tim Burton brought to that picture, watch Big Top Pee-wee. You know, it's very, he could have gone that route. His second film could have been another Pee-wee Herman film. And you can see what Pee-wee Herman brings to a film and what Burton brings to the film when you watch Big Top Pee-wee next to Beetlejuice.
The other thing that I think of when I think of Tim Burton, though, is really Danny Elfman. And this was my introduction to him. I mean, again, I'd seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I'd heard a few Oingo Boingo songs. I mean, I saw Back to School in theaters. I knew Dead Man's Party. And Weird Science, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got to know Weird Science.
But this era of Elfman music is really what made me the movie score fan I am. The fact that Elfman and these things for this movie, Batman, Nightbreed, were the first things that made me go out and seek score albums.
Yeah, I think that for Elfman, like Burton, it was a real blooming. Like, yeah, they worked before, but after this point, they were a name brand. They meant something. You knew instantly when you heard their name what they brought to the table. It was going to be an out-of-control carnival soundtrack if you hired Elfman. And if you bring Burton, it's going to be gothic cuteness. And so, I mean, it's defined in this second film here. Your second film can either bring you down and ruin you, or it can turn you into a household name. And I definitely think that that Beetlejuice, much more than a story, is a portfolio to show what Burton and Elfman can do. So Arnie, why don't you give them the plot? We'll get into Beetlejuice.
Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis play Adam and Barbara Maitland, a couple from Winter River, Connecticut. You could say they live happily in their house, except they're not living. They died in a car wreck and are to spend the next 125 years haunting that abode. They'd find it idyllic until the Dietzes move in, including ex-yuppie Charles, played by Jeffrey Jones, his goth daughter Lydia, played by Winona Ryder, and self-proclaimed artist and Lydia's stepmother, Delia, played by Catherine O'Hara. With the help of interior decorator Ortho, Delia begins to transform the Maitlands' home, and so the ghosts want the humans gone. When their own spook tactics fail to scare away the yuppies, they call on bio-exorcist Beetlejuice, played by Michael Keaton. He is a reckless rogue ghost who enjoys terrifying humans, and he does scare the Dietzes, but they see this as a key to riches. But while her parents want to profit from the ghosts, Lydia befriends the lost spirits. Ortho performs a resurrection to make the Maitlands appear, but accidentally begins to exorcise them. To save them, Lydia calls on Beetlejuice and even agrees to marry him if he'll save Adam and Barbara, which he does. But Barbara banishes them back to the other world, and the Dietzes and Maitlands find a way to live happily together in the house as credits roll. Not much of a story. There's not a lot of plot here. This movie is about style and gags and visuals. And when I sat down to write a plot summary, I'm like, I could go into every bit of minutiae. I could talk about their caseworker Juno, but really, it's ghosts in a house who want the humans gone, and so they call on a worse ghost.
Yeah, but I find that what sets a lot of movies apart. Like, there's not a whole lot of unique story. It's how you tell it, and Tim Burton, at least at one time, Tim Burton could really jazz up a kind of boring story with his visuals. And you get it right away with these opening credits going over this miniature of the town, which they try to play, you know, as the real thing. But you got, look, Elfman, man, I've never really paid attention to his score in this film. I love this score. This is, wow, knock it out with this opening theme as they go over this miniatures of the town.
Oh, just the opening, because for whatever reason, and I don't think you could ever find a real reason with Burton, but Calypso music is going to play heavily. Yes. Harry Belafonte looms over this movie as the real ghost on the screen, and the fact that it starts with that spooky daylight come and me won't go home.
Well, here's what I believe about Tim Burton is that, you know, as much as he has tried to create the self-image of the goth, pallid skin, mussed up, dark hair, this figure of spectral death, he comes from sunny California and he comes from suburbia, Burbank. You really can't get more ordinary than that. And I think that that contrast is his vision. You always talk about Tim Burton movies being dark, but they're also very sunny. And it's that pairing of old 60s nostalgia, the 50s and 60s, which Harry Belafonte did represent. He was a popular artist at that time, contrasted with the influences, I think, that Tim Burton cultivated, which are Charles Adams, illustrator and drawer of the Addams Family cartoon, and Edward Gorey. I don't know if you know his work. I read his books as a kid. There are a series of children's books in which dead children usually factor into the pages. He has a very distinctive illustrative style. I urge you to seek him out. I feel like those two elements are really inspiring Tim Burton to recharacterize and redraw 50s, 60s LA suburbia. But this is not LA. It's worth pointing out they're in Connecticut. They're in cow country.
I do like the opening over the miniature. The way the spider comes over, it kind of just sets the tone of you think you see something that's very pretty, but there's something ugly behind it or something dangerous. And yeah, Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, just this happy, childless, married couple taking the ultimate two-week staycation to stay home. He's going to work on his models. She's wallpapering. And there's this one character who does not get a whole lot of attention, but Jane the realtor comes by. She's selling their house even though they don't want to sell. And she says something that's like, this should be with a couple with a family. And Gina Davis gets this hurt look. It never really goes anywhere, but it says maybe they couldn't have kids and they wanted to, or...
Well, they say they are going to try during their staycation. They'll try again. But yeah, they've had trouble having kids. I get the feeling at this point.
Yeah, and that was a little more clear in the script that I read. I think what we're to get is that in small town America, you need to fit the bill. And why this couple isn't totally integrated. They're up on the hill. They live above this charming Norman Rockwell world, but they don't reside in it. Much like Edward Scissorhands never resided in it because they don't have children. And that's really, I think, the dramatic arc of this whole film. Is this film is about a childless couple that wanted to fix up their old house and ended up filling it with a child by the end.
Yeah, I find this film, as I'm watching it with the now playing goggles and writing down all the little details, there is an internal logic to everything that happens. You could argue if that logic's good or not. Like, we're stuck in this house for 125 years, so do we try to get rid of these people? Like, I never picked up that they were stuck there for a certain amount of time. But yeah, the fact that Jane, who I believe is, what, Barbara's sister? She comes up, and it's a man from New York City that wants to buy the house. Like, they are planting all these seeds for what happens later.
Oh, I didn't realize Jane was a relative. I never realized that. I just thought she was really a bitchy realtor.
She went to the funeral. That's dedication.
Yeah, but it's a small town. Everyone goes to the funeral, right? Again, she's part of a town. She's trying to cultivate an image, and part of the image would be to have a nuclear family living in Winter River, is the name of this town. I think that this movie would be easier to get, would, I think, help me with all of the hiccups that I have with establishing who's the main character, is if they switched them. If Gina Davis and Baldwin played the outlandish, buffoonish New Yorkers that crashed this house, and that we had Jeffrey Jones and Catherine O'Hara be the normal couple. They look normal and boring. And that's the point, is that this couple is supposed to be ordinary, and they're in a movie where everything is going to overshadow them. I think you'd want the stars of the movie, as it certainly read in the script, were the Dietzes and not the Maitlands.
See, I think the Maitlands are the stars of the movie. We start with them and we're on their side. We are to not like the Dietzes.
Oh, no, they are the stars of the movie. I'm saying that's the wrong focus.
Oh, I like it this way. I really do. I want to know more about the other world. If we didn't get the movie we get with all the bureaucracy we're going to talk about and the handbook for the recently deceased, then I think we'd have a lot of these questions. The fact that we are going on a journey to death, our point of view characters are going to be two people who literally plunge off a bridge 8 minutes into the movie and drown. And they don't remember how they got back home. I do love the drowning scene with the dog. And you know, it's this cute little dog. They die trying not to hit a dog. The dog jumps off the ledge that could have saved their life and then just watches them drown.
At Frankenweenie, I think it might even be the same dog, but that was about a dog that came back to life. I think they're doing Night of the Living Dead. Later, they'll have Lydia ask them, haven't you ever seen it? But Barbara, right? They were brother-sister back then. But I think that that's what we're supposed to think of by seeing them killed so soon, is that it seemed like a perfect day out. It's their hardware store. I don't think that's clearly established, but he runs that hardware store. They've closed it while they stay at home, and he's running in just to get some stuff for the models. But yeah, they take this plunge over a covered bridge, a fall that we can all admit would not kill them, and that if it did, by this movie's internal logic, they should come back with bloated skin and spitting out fishes.
I took it that they drowned. I guess they couldn't get the doors open. I will say, yes, here is where the internal logic doesn't hold up, is that when we get to that scene later on in the waiting room, in the afterlife, you look like however you died, apparently, and they are not bloated. They're not turned blue from not being able to breathe. And how did they get home? Like, we're going to find out the outside world is all dune style sandworms, but they walk home because they still think they're alive at this point.
Well, they don't know how they got home. So I took it always that they were teleported home. What I read is Burton had been asked, why didn't they look like they drown? And he said drowning was chosen because you wouldn't see a lot of effect on the body, but that it just wasn't going to be comfortable for the actors to be wet the entire time. That's what they'd considered, is they'd constantly hose down Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, and they decided not to do that.
Wouldn't it make more sense? I don't know if sense is the right word, but wouldn't it dramatically have more at stake as if they were trying to sell this house, if they were working with that realtor, if they knew it was too big for them, and they knew that they weren't gonna, she couldn't have kids? And now the hell of it all is that they're now stuck in a house they could never get rid of.
All right. Maybe it's because I've lived with this movie so long that I feel every time you're like, wouldn't it be better if... No, not really. I can't say that because I like the fact... Maybe it's because I don't have kids. I'm very happily married. I don't have a model of the town, but I do have a lot of toys. I relate to this couple, and I could think of nothing better than 125 years alone in this house with my wife. So I don't think it would be better if they were trying to move out and trap there. I like that what it is yuppies infringing upon their small town idyllic happiness.
Well, yeah, this is a very middle America versus the elitist people on the coast type of, you see this in movies all the time. It's like, oh, the weird art people from New York are coming in and they're ruining our nice little cottage because this is just downright Americana. Like you said, Stuart, as crazy as Tim Burton, his image is, there is the sense of just America. Kana to him in suburbia, and I feel like that is what they're trying to preserve, is they like their home, they want to be there, and they don't want to share it with the weirdos.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the clash ends up being, but I guess what I'm saying is it's not really well demonstrated. This is not a very good script, and Tim Burton does what he does to retool it to make it look cool, but I actually feel like it's really clunky. It isn't working for me.
There's only one point in this movie, and I've always felt it, we'll get there, where I have a problem with the script, basically the story more than the script, just a story beat. But I really like seeing these two at home. I have always loved the line, and I use it repeatedly, though I don't exactly know what it means. When they get home, they find the handbook for the recently deceased, and Alec Baldwin says, it reads like stereo instructions. I've never read stereo instructions.
Oh, they're impossible. Yeah. It's like the reason, you know, all those old jokes about trying to set the timer on your VCR. It's because it was impossible to understand unless you were an engineer.
Yeah, and just not prose. You know, like it's very mechanical writing in which you get no sense of, here are people that are like, all right, are we in hell? Are we going to meet angels? Are there devils? They want to know emotionally what they're about to face. And all they're hearing is like, you know, open the door here, sit there. It's very technical when they would like to be comforted.
And that is the charm of this movie, is the Kafkaesque bureaucracy of the afterworld. Again, we always call out Terry Gilliam and Brazil. You know, that was always his thing, is to show this hellish bureaucracy, but that's what I enjoy most about this film, is they take the afterlife and you only get so many vouchers to meet with your caseworker, and you're going to be stuck here, and you know, you're number 9 million in line. Like, it's all how you dress up this story.
And the fact that they're trying to live a regular life while being dead, you know, they're trying to sleep in the same bed and she's floating above it, Ghostbusters style. Gina Davis always reminded me of like a not as good Sigourney Weaver anyway in the 80s with the hair and some of the build.
They wanted Sigourney, they approached her.
I could see it, yeah. And so to see her floating next to the bed.
Actually, number one choice was Kirstie Alley, but she couldn't get out of Cheers.
Thank God. Have you seen Look Who's Talking, or even worse, Look Who's Talking Now?
But if she had been in this movie, she might have been offered a whole series of movies and never made those bad choices.
It would have been Gina Davis in Look Who's Talking.
I don't think Gina Davis is naturally a comedian. I mean, she's done many comedies and been good in them. But I think if you cast someone that is associated with a sitcom, you might see the main characters more as funny instead of bland. And then again, that's what I'm fighting against here, is that these people are bland and they're in a world that I'd much rather explore anyone but them.
And that's what I like, is that they are bland and they're in this crazy world. They're the straight men, the straight couple. And that works for me. I praised Elfman's score here. There are moments, though, in the score where it goes real 80s sitcom. Like those. I don't want Adam and Barbara doing those kind of hijinks. I want them to be trying to live this normal, bland life with crazy ghosts and crazy New Yorkers all around them.
I noticed that, too, Jacob. I've had the score album for a long time. For this review, I got the 25th anniversary Blu-ray, which had virtually no features other than 3 episodes of the cartoon I suffered through, and a soundtrack-only feature where I could just listen to the Harry Belafonte and the score. And when I heard some bits of those score that never made it on the soundtrack, that was some of that boop, 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 I was like, whoa, I never knew that was in there.
Yeah, you guys are saying you're liking this conflict. I'm not saying I dislike. I just wanted to be clear. I just recognize that there's just not a lot of conflict here. Okay, these people that always wanted to stay home are get to stay home forever. Boring. So the conflict, the tension has got to be coming from who's moving in now, the Dietzes.
And of course, I did know Jeffrey Jones very well by this point, having seen Howard the Duck over 100 times. Then, of course, Ferris Bueller too.
Yeah, that's the one, Arnie. It's not Howard the Duck.
It all goes back to Howard for Arnie.
I'm telling you, when I read the script, I'm like, this was meant to be a star vehicle for Chevy Chase. Chevy Chase was supposed to be in Ghostbusters. this was going to be his Ghostbusters. I have no doubt about it. Everything was built around Charles, if you can believe it. Charles is a writer. He's trying to write his great American novel. That's why they moved to small town America.
Didn't Chevy Chase do that movie? Wasn't that called Funny Farm? And it wasn't funny.
Yes, he's made it, and so has everyone else. But I definitely feel like he was trying to say, God damn it, I'm going to have my Ghostbusters, and this is going to be it. And it was just much more about him trying to be in this environment. Instead, by making it Jeffrey Jones, you just kind of ignore him. He's not a big enough threat, and he's not playing off of Alec Baldwin at all.
No, but I like how he plays off his wife and Otho. Like, he's the one that wants that country life, and the other two are going through, like, spray painting mauve, like, whatever color they're going to paint the walls. And he's like, this is my one room. Like, I like this family dynamic here.
I'll come down the middle and say that I wouldn't want this movie to have any more subplots than it has.
Mm-mm.
I think that it's a wonderfully sleek 90 minutes. I don't think it needs to be longer. I didn't get, when I saw this in the 80s, that Jeffrey Jones was this yuppie who's trying to basically escape that life. He says now he's coming to relax. And now I've seen that a lot in 80s and 90s stories about the yuppies who get the ulcers and have enough money, so they decide to relax and go to the country. But we find out that Lydia is Charles' real daughter, but Delia is a stepmother. And I do not understand the relationship between Charles and Delia at all. And this Ortho who runs around with Delia, maybe Delia is the artifact of the life Charles is trying to leave behind, is that kind of high pressure, artsy world. And Delia is still enwrapped in that. But to see her and Ortho trying to interact with Charles, trying to interact with Lydia, it's almost like you've got people from three separate families.
Yeah, I don't think it works. I don't think it makes sense that this New York underground artist is trying to make small town America work. They've tried to retrofit it so that it can still remain the Maitlands as the main character. But if those had been people that we didn't know very well, and we had gotten to this family moving in here, and they were the stars, this would be a much cleaner story.
It may be, but I don't know that it would be as fun, because I do like Delia's art. I do like Ortho, who is a character actor who I'd see in a few other things, not too often.
Demolition Man.
Yeah, he was in that. He'll show up, and every time I see him, I'll be like, hey, it's Ortho.
Yes.
I really think I related to this movie in 1988, though, because of Winona Ryder as Lydia. This was an actress I didn't really know. Like I said, she came to me in a 1-2 punch, Heather's in this. And in both movies, she was a little bit of an outcast. She was a little bit depressed. And as she says here, I think I would have described myself in junior high as strange and unusual. So I really clicked with that character and her estrangement from her parents.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that she's not blonde, right? The 80s were like, blondes have more fun, and fun is what we want in the 80s. Goth. We didn't know what that was. That wasn't a thing.
Yeah, Tim Burton must have been a Cure fan into Robert Smith, because those are the only people that I would have called goths that I knew, like, in the late 80s. That came later in the 90s with Nine Inch Nails, but there were those Cure fans that wanted to look like Robert Smith in the late 80s, and I guess Burton was one of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's where Edward Scissorhands got his haircut.
Yeah, and so this is clearly the Burtonian character that's been refashioned as such, and it makes you feel like she should be the star of the movie. Like, that should be the focus character then, because, yes, she's going to explore this world of ghosts. She's not going to be impressed with the Maitlands. They're trying to put on sheets and be cliched haunted house, and that's not going to get her at all. She's the character, I think, also because I was a kid when I saw this, that I cling to, and that the cartoon built around. It made a lot of sense to make the movie about the girl that has her whole life ahead of her, and yet she can only see death and Beetlejuice. That's, to me, the interesting characters in this movie.
And I also could relate to her angst very well as a teenager. Seeing it as an adult, I can also relate, because her angst doesn't really have any source. It's just generalized angst. She's being forced to move by her parents.
It's just puberty, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd been forced to move mid-high school with my parents, and the fact that she just doesn't get along with her mother, I didn't get along with either of my parents. It's aimless. It doesn't have a specific route. I do like that her father's kind of on her side, though. He'll let stuff slide. When he sees the sheets and thinks it's Lydia, he's like, you better not let your mother see you cut holes in those $300 sheets. He doesn't care, but he knows that it'll cause a fight between Lydia and Delia. It's there in those little lines, and I do think she becomes our point of view character into both sides, the Dietzes and the Maitlands.
I mean, this movie is everything that Winona Ryder is in it, and she would become the icon for our generation. And yeah, she's essential to this movie. I just throw it out there. Don't you think Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, given what we know about them certainly now, would be more fun as her parents, and that Jeffrey Jones and Catherine O'Hara make more sense as the ghosts?
No, I want ghosts that have fun. I want to see Gina Davis. Now, Alec Baldwin in this movie is a bit of a flat note.
Yeah, he's not Alec Baldwin. We think of Alec Baldwin, entitled, arrogant, rich guy, yuppie, who, you know, is going to chew out the salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross, or, yeah, steal the scenery in Saturday Night Live. We want him to do that in this film as well, and that is the Charles character.
But all of that happened later in his career, and at this point, he's so, with those glasses and those highlights, doesn't look like Alec Baldwin, that it took me probably 15 years to reconcile this wasn't a different Baldwin brother in this movie.
Yeah, is it Billy? Which one is it?
Yeah, it's called miscasting. He's not right for the role that they put him in.
I don't know. I like the fact, I think part of the humor here is that you have these square ghosts. You think of ghosts being scary, and like at one point, their caseworker is going to be like, okay, show me what you're going to do to scare them. I got to make sure you know what you're doing. Because they are so bland and boring, I think that's part of the humor, is that, yeah, they're going to use designer sheets to try to scare a family because they don't know what they're doing, and that's why you're going to have to go to this extreme ghost later.
Well, that's certainly what it becomes. I mean, certainly that is where Tim Burton found his way into the movie, and why so much time is given to them exploring the manual and learning the ropes of the afterlife. Not in the script, all stuff that Burton came up with.
Like the whole waiting room is not in the script?
Nothing. There was no caseworker. There was no waiting room. There was none of that.
See, that is the movie to me. That is the charm, is the bureaucracy of the afterlife here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this comes because they don't know what to do. The Maitlands are remodeling the house, and it is completely gaudy what they're adding to the house. They're making it look like, I used to build sets out of like Fisher Price and Lincoln logs and things, and then after you build your house, you still have more logs, and so you add on something really enormously weird, and you don't have enough roof pieces, so it's roofless. That's kind of what they've done to this house. And so they decide they need help. They finally read in the book that they can go get help by creating a door. And that's just a wonderfully cartoon Wile E. Coyote thing. You draw a door and then you walk through it. But when they walk through that door is when this movie really elevates into what I consider a classic. When we start visiting the other world, there's a dropped line by Ortho later on. People who kill themselves in this life are forced to be civil servants in the next, and every single person there is some form of suicide.
Oh, I agree with you. It is what we think of the movie now. It is not what it was conceived as, but it is what Beetlejuice means now. That waiting room scene is everything, honestly.
Well, I would say the musical number is the go-to, but yes, this waiting room scene is what makes the film.
Yeah, and just all of the various visuals here, the fact that they're in some weird M.C. Escher forced perspective, everything's askew, land is tremendously fun, and all the people in the waiting room, the guy who got run over by the truck, just seeing all these modes of death comedically. It is so lighthearted when you're dealing with, you know, in the hands of Wes Craven, this could have been just a gore fest.
Yeah, but I mean, again, it wasn't in the original horror conception of it, and I do think, again, go back to those illustrators. Edward Gorey, that's his bag. That's what he did. He made death look silly. He made cute look unnerving and unnerving look cute. And I think Tim Burton is glomming onto that. And we just have a lot of ideas. I talked a lot when we covered David Lynch in a series about how artists sometimes, you know, they're just creating paintings. It doesn't necessarily attach to anything else. You can experience something like Eraserhead as just walking through a gallery. That's also how I experience Beetlejuice. I have to divorce myself from what's not working in the script and just say, yeah, fun ideas. These are like Garbage Pail Kid cards. These are our spirits and characters I'd want to know more about. It is a portfolio. It is not a story.
Okay, I guess I kind of get what you're saying. This is a world. This is world building. And then he's just creating this vision of this other place. So, you know, crazy bureaucratic afterlife and weird New Yorkers coming in. To me, the story is a way to get all that out. I don't have a problem with any of the story here because I'm enjoying the film so much because it is just so bizarre and zany.
Exactly where I'm at. I find the story sufficient and entertaining as a framework for what is, yeah, tremendous art direction. It's rare that I'm watching a movie and I'm really pulled out by the use of color, but the fact of the use of the reds and the greens and the grays and the blues that Burton paints this screen with is absolutely remarkable, and I'm left with a smile on my face. So could the story be better? It could be if the movie needed it, but this movie has exactly what it needs in story because it's a setup that continually gets payoff, like the caseworker Juno, who slit her own throat, and so when she smokes, the smoke comes out of it.
What I'm hearing is you guys like this movie a whole lot more than I do, and it's telling that you guys saw it 100 times. I've only seen it once. So there's part of it, is I don't have any association for what this should be. I'm experiencing it almost like the first time watching it and feeling like if this story is about trying to get humans out of a haunted house, why is it taking 40 minutes to get to Michael Keaton? Now, they know that there's a problem, so they have sprinkled them in here.
Yeah, at the 25-minute mark, you see him going through some ads.
I do like that scene where he's like, let me look at the help wanted section. It's the obituaries. I also like just, it's a needless scene to remind us Beetlejuice is in the film later on, but the callback to the fly, he pulls a fly under and the fly's like, help me, help me.
Yeah, again, that's very corny. Is that funny to reference a 1958 Vincent Price movie? It is if you're Tim Burton and that's the world you live in, where half of it feels like the 50s and half of it feels like gothic 80s.
And that's what I was saying at the beginning when I was 11 years old watching this. I just don't get it. Why is there a fly being eaten? Why is it saying, help me? I don't understand. Like, I didn't, to me, this is a pretty funny film now, but not for kids. I just think it's a different kind of humor because you have to understand how these things juxtapose and work against each other. You just don't have that reference point as a kid.
And I was 14 when I saw it, and I think that was the minimum age because I had seen The Fly. I did know the Help Me references, and I got the humor. I think this is one of the first films as a child that I got 95% of. It's just some of the yuppie stuff that I feel like I've added as an adult.
This is PG-13, right?
No, it's PG. It's one of the very few PG films to get an F word in the era of PG-13.
How strange. I would definitely feel like this is made to be excluding 13 and under.
Yeah, there's a whorehouse. Now I know why my grandma's uncomfortable after she took me to this.
I don't want to come off too harsh, like I'm not having a good time. I just want to make it clear. I think it is a quirky picture book, but I am constantly aware that nothing is happening. And that is bothering me. It is bothering me that half the movie has gone by and nothing has moved forward.
To me, I'm liking the scenes with the other world. And when they come back, I mean, when they walk through all this bureaucracy, they're back in the house and time has jumped. The remodel is now complete. It is no longer their house.
Yeah, it's taken them 3 months to get through the house.
Mm-hmm.
They essentially can't leave this house for 125 years or something.
Yeah.
But every time they do, they had an earlier scene, too, where they stepped off the porch and they were in sand dunes. And we find out that it's patrolled by these giant snakes.
In one of the scripts, maybe this was in the one you read, Stuart, every time they left, it was going to be a different world. And there's a line in this one where Beetlejuice says, I've been to Saturn, you've been to Saturn. Apparently, this is one of the moons of Saturn that has the dune-like sandworms.
Is that what that meant?
Yes, that's exactly what it meant. And I want to point out, Beetlejuice is a star. It is where they got the name. They spell it like the star. It is cosmology. It has nothing to do with H.P. Lovecraft, which that was also a demon in that.
I was wondering if they originally were going to go with the actual spelling for the star Beetlejuice, because we see that spelling in some of like the TV ads throughout this film. But then they just go, you know, Beetle is in the bug. I wonder if they're like, we can't give it too weird of a name or people won't know what to say at the ticket booth when they're buying their ticket.
That's exactly what it is. But that has bugged me for 30 years because I've always always wondered why in the movie it looks like it's Beetlegeist.
Yeah, why isn't it Beetlegeist?
And yet in the sign and everything, it's Beetlejuice. It's always bugged me. According to Wikipedia, marketing people said Beetlejuice is funnier and will sell better. And it worked.
Yes, and they knew that people wouldn't, like, much like this couple, they wouldn't know how to say it if the title was actually spelled the way that the character uses it. Beetlejuice, that is how you spell it if you're writing about the star, but you spell it out as it explains itself in a Pictionary game. Beetle plus orange juice is the way that is going to make more sense for more of the audience.
Plus, that just has that slightly icky kind of feel. Beetlejuice is what I think of when I step on a beetle and then I have to clean up off the floor. I don't think of it as innards and blood. I think of it as Beetlejuice.
Warner Brothers did not want it to be the name. They tried everything. And, you know, Ghost House, I mean, it got really generic at some point.
What happened was Tim Burton decided to punk them and decided to tell them that it should be called Scared Sheetless. And they loved it. They're like, okay, that's the title.
Jeez.
Yeah, they were worried about the weirdness, as any studio would. But, you know, there had been a proven track record at this point. The 80s was filled with special effects films that, as long as it had a visual appealing idea, it wasn't going to offend people. No one was religiously offended by Ghostbusters, you know, and I think they ultimately just, yeah, as long as you spell it like people could spell it at home, we'll let you call it Beetlejuice. But he isn't the main character, and he isn't the focus, and it's just damn weird that it's taken this long. In the script, the book told them how to get to Beetlejuice. Instead of going to the office and all of that wonderful stuff that I do enjoy that this movie needs and could never purge itself from, but instead of doing all of that, they just flipped to a page that said, why don't you contact Beetlejuice? And they dig him up inside the model graveyard.
See, I like how this movie does it more. They set him up as dangerous. I think Juno says that was a former student of hers that went rogue. And yeah, he is the antagonist of this film. And so you want him to feel dangerous. If you just read a book, said, hey, get this guy to do it for you, you don't have that tension there. There's not that sense of danger. I mean, when Adam and Barbara go and meet Beetlejuice for the first time, they finally say his name and go down into the miniature and dig him up. There is a sense of dread because this is taboo what they're doing.
They do make Beetlejuice feel outside the system by establishing a system and then having this guy who has gone rogue coming to them on his own. And, you know, for a movie that is going to drop lines to explain a lot of things like where the civil servants come from and how long you have to be in the house, never know how Beetlejuice ended up in this graveyard or anything. Don't need to know that. When he finally does show up, though, is where the movie ramps. And I remember seeing a lot of him in trailers.
Oh, yeah, this whole scene is what the trailers were. Him talking to Barbara and Adam, dressing up as them, yeah.
One of the big things I wanted to see in this movie, because in the trailers, when they said, can you be scary, and he does whatever that face is with the snakes, they didn't show it in the trailers. I'm like, oh, that's got to be so gross and so scary. I need to see that. And then I see the movie itself, and they still don't show it. But coming back to it, I was shocked that it's like 45 minutes before we get to that point, but I've had fun getting there. It's just when he's on the screen, he's electric.
Yeah, I haven't been bored up to this point. And when he does show up, it's that Tim Burton sensibility that it's lo-fi. We're going to take Michael Keaton. We're just going to paint him white and put some black around the eyes. We're not going to do prosthetics. We're going to make it look almost like a kid's costume.
And I think a lot of that was Keaton himself. Keaton did a lot of ad-libbing. Keaton brought a lot to this character and worked on developing him with Burton. And I'm going to say something a little risky. Stuart, I think if this movie had a lot more Beetlejuice in it, you'd say it's too much. I consider him to be like the Spicoli or something. You don't want too much of him. When he comes in, everything goes sideways. Everything is constantly manic. That's the energy this character brings. If you had too much of that, you'd get sick of it.
Oh, agreed. He couldn't be the main character. You need to have the straight man, but you want to feature him more than this movie does. I'm also going to say, I just don't think he's that funny. What he does is quirky, and this movie is quirky, but it is not laugh out loud funny. It is mostly corny, and that if you're wanting to come to this like for great jokes, they're not here.
Well, you know, that's what confused me as an 11-year-old. I thought it was going to be a slapstick Leonard Part 6. Ha-ha, that's, you know, funny. I'm just trying to think of a really bad film I laughed at as a kid. But yet, what I appreciate now as an adult, yeah, is that it is just quirky. I just smile as I watch it. I'm being entertained. I'm not busting a gut, but I'm not flatlining either. There's just a good level of enjoyment throughout the film that just, it maintains. It doesn't peak, it doesn't valley a whole lot, but it's got a high bar for me of just wanting to smile while I watch this and be entertained by all the goofiness.
I'll agree. I'll take your statement and turn it into a metaphor. Sometimes I don't want to get smash face drunk. Sometimes I just want to feel a little mellow. And that's kind of where this movie puts me. There's one moment of Beetlejuice when I find it just absolutely hysterical and I still laugh out loud. And that's after his first attack. He comes in, they call him to scare the Maitlands because they failed. He does this snake attack, which reminded me even then of Nightmare on Elm Street 3, the Freddy snake.
I think there's a lot of Freddy Krueger here. I think in the design, when they wrote that first draft, they were thinking about Nightmare on Elm Street.
But then they send him back and he gets kind of pissed off that he wasn't allowed to finish the work when he somehow ejects metal spikes and then dances his way into a horror house. That has always made me laugh. Just Michael Keaton's weird dance while wearing the pointy suit. It's something like I would expect a team mascot to do or something. I don't know. I always love it.
It makes you wonder why he didn't play the Joker. If this is their first collaboration and Burton's next film is Batman, this is clearly why that movie was all about Jack Nicholson running around and being big and boisterous, is that he loves this character. He is an introvert and he loves seeing extroverts. And so that is the fascination here of I want... You know, the duality in a Tim Burton movie is there's always a character that's just gothic and withdrawn and doesn't do anything. Here it's Lydia. And then the character that does everything and that they could do so much for each other by working together. But yeah, it is a warm up for Joker, but Keaton is playing the Joker. And that is kind of what I find interesting about it.
Yeah, and that's why I always thought this came out after Batman in my mind, in my memory. Because yeah, Keaton is so outrageous. He's so different than when he plays Bruce Wayne.
And I think this movie is a large part of the reason why people rebelled against him as Batman. I know I was part of that. I'm like, but he's Beetlejuice. How can Beetlejuice be Batman? That just doesn't work. And it's because we hadn't seen Keaton give a range, and I still don't know that we've seen, I guess, Birdman, people like him in, but I still don't know that he's given a whole lot of range in the projects I've liked him in. But to me, this movie was paving the way for my excitement for Batman.
Yeah, this is the tipping point. This is the last, this and what, Dream Team were the last big comedy performances that Keaton would give. And after that point, I think maybe part of the reason why we never got a Beetlejuice 2 was he just didn't, I've done it. This is it. I've done big comedy guy, and now I want to do other stuff. But yeah, you're catching him at the height of that. But he had been doing it all the 80s, from Night Shift, which also had sort of a Undertaker macabre death theme to it. It was about a whorehouse being run out of a morgue. And he was the wild and crazy guy that was helping Henry Winkler do that. I do think that, yeah, this is just in his wheelhouse. It's what you'd expect Keaton to do in 1988, but it may not be what you expect him to do after Batman.
But yeah, he is a bolt of energy in here. Now, here's the one plot point that I said I have a problem with.
Is the use of Calypso music to scare people?
No, I love the Deo scene. I love, love, love Deo. I was a Harry Belafonte fan for... at least 2 years. You know, keep in mind I was only 14 by the time this came out. And Deo was the song I sang every day in class during seventh period. I just couldn't wait. So I just sit there in my mind writing in my notebook, "Daylight coming, me won't go home."
Is that your version of All Work and No Play from The Shining?
Yes, it literally was. If you look through my notebook, it was just handwritten pages of Daylight Coming, Me Won't Go Home, page after page of it. That's how I got through my classes seventh period. And so, yes, I love the shrimp scene, and I absolutely love Jeffrey Jones as the Black Tarantula. They only show him. I would love to see, like, what Catherine O'Hara was told to do for the Black Tarantula.
I see. I hated this scene then. And I hate it now. I just don't.
What?
Why? Why?
This is the funny thing, though. It's the square ghost. Like, this is what they think is going to get these people to go run out of the house screaming, is this goofy dance possession scene. I don't know. To me, that's what makes this film works, is that you have the worst scary ghost ever and then an actual scary ghost.
And they reach Harry Belafonte because the first scene had them playing Shake Sonora. They are just square.
Yeah, they're playing his music throughout the film.
And so Harry Belafonte represents squareness, and thus, instead of getting The Exorcist, we're getting Harry Belafonte. I just don't see much point. And this was big. You're right. This may be even bigger than the waiting room scene. They ran this on MTV. There was a music video of Deo.
It charted.
Yeah, but I just never got why.
You know what got me for this is the first time I saw it, I did think this is awfully weird, but I liked the end where the hands come out of the shrimp bowls and shove them. I'm like, that's the real scary part, is you kind of lulled them into having a fun dance time, but then you punch them in the face.
It's the Freddy Krueger move, right? Like, he was doing this kind of stuff coming out of pizzas and such around this time.
And I just love the acting of all six people, including Ortho's weird girlfriend that never really does much, and another yuppie couple who's apparently Delia's agent and his wife who never do a whole lot.
You do know that's Dick Cavett, right?
I know the name Dick Cavett the same way I know the name Robert Goulet. And I know them for being famous, but I couldn't tell you why anybody likes either.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, he was at the inception of talk show hosts. He was there before Donahue, before Oprah, before anybody. He was as big or bigger than Johnny Carson.
By this point, I primarily knew him because there was the scene where he interviewed Zsa Zsa Gabor in Dream Warriors.
Okay, yeah, he's whoring himself out at this point. No one was calling him for interviews anymore, so he needed to do bit parts in silly special effects movies.
So when this doesn't work, yeah, they call Beetlejuice, and then Lydia gets all mad at them, like, oh, why are you doing this? Lydia knows that the Dietzes want them gone, and Lydia should know that the snake creature isn't them because we haven't seen them able to transform. That Lydia suddenly feels so betrayed by Adam and Barbara at this point has always felt weird to me.
Oh, see, I always thought it was because it attacked her father, that things got mean all of a sudden. Before, it was just, we're going to put on bed sheets and we're kind of just goofy ghosts. And now this is something scary.
Yeah, that's how it reads, is that basically it was a joke that went too far. She could support them doing Deo. She could not support, but let's just call it out. It's phallic. It's sexualized. It's a sexual threat to her, who presumably she's still a virgin. So there's that underlying all of that. And this, the rest of this movie, it's kind of a stalker scenario about an underage girl potentially being a child bride or a corpse bride.
I do like the scene where, as a snake, Beetlejuice gets under Delia's skirt and Delia runs. I mean, he is very libidinous.
Yeah, and it's specifically targeting her at this point. It's the thrust of the rest of this movie, is that if he's going to help at all, we're not sure what motivates him, but I think he just likes chaos. But if he's going to help at all, it's because he wants to. Again, why wouldn't he like Lydia? And why wouldn't Lydia like him?
Yeah, it's kind of weird when she's like, I want to come to the other side. He's like, why? I think he'd be helping her plot her suicide. And yeah, why he wants to marry her. He says some line that I've honestly believed about being like an illegal alien, and if he can marry a human, he can escape that world.
Yeah, that is the weird thing. There is so much internal logic. Again, whether it makes sense or not, that's another thing. But there's all this internal logic. Like, the agent, he's like, well, this whole possession dance isn't enough to convince me that there's ghosts. We need actual proof. And then we're going to get Ortho. He's going to steal the book so he could summon the ghost. Like, there's all this logic. But then all of a sudden with Beetlejuice, it's just like, yeah, I want to marry you, Lydia, and that will stop me from being a ghost if I could get married to a human. Huh? It's just all of a sudden out of nowhere.
And, you know, it's had the reverse effect too, that Adam and Barbara thought that if they could prove to this couple their house was legitimately haunted, they would want nothing to do with it. And the punchline is, no, now we can make money at it because these are New Yorkers and they're enterprising. They're calling up their real estate friends to invest and to basically turn the whole town into a theme park. Shouldn't the town be more of a factor here? I feel like we should know people in the town. We got little bits of the realtor and the barbershop guy, but it's a mistake of this movie that we didn't understand there was a small town America that was being perverted.
I don't want a whole lot more in this movie, but I guess you could have had some reaction shots to see how the town is dealing with the Dietzes.
I felt like there should have been more of that watching it this time, because we do have the entire miniature of the house to see Charles come in and perhaps more overtly get his yuppie-ish ways of taking the land and being a land baron. It's hinted at here, but this is both a small movie in terms of budget and in terms of storytelling. It's going to stay in the house. They don't go that way. I'm not necessarily missing it, but I did wish I got more than the one babbling old man and the one realtor.
Yeah, they could have done it just by having one scene where they hosted the town. They invited people to come up and walk through the new house that they had redesigned, and we could just get to know those people and what was at stake if big money New York came in and changed it.
Yeah, everybody's looking at the house from the window. It's a weird kind of voyeuristic thing of whoever's living in that house above the city. Even Adam was watching the city, not being part of the city. He was recreating the city even when he was alive. Charles moves in and starts doing the same thing. But then we get another, what I would consider iconic scene, because they called on Beetlejuice. Juno comes back and is like, let me see your scary faces. And they're both kind of parrot face, big beaked. Spy versus spy is my go-to.
Mad Magazine for sure is what I was thinking about. Again, this is an illustrator behind the camera. All his ideas are coming from Looney Tunes, from Mad Magazine, from Edward Gorey and Charles Adams.
I never found that especially scary either, especially when Adam has to put his fingers up to his glasses to see his wife.
Yeah, it's sweet. It's Tim Burton scary. It's not scary. It's, isn't it cute that something so wretched and disgusting could, you know, also be cuddly?
I gauge scariness with my 7-year-old. Like, where is she turning away? And earlier on, like, when they don't know, adults can't see them, like, Barbara's ripping her face off as she's hanging herself in the closet. That was too scary for the 7-year-old. These goofy faces, she thought we were charming.
Kids are going to gravitate towards this movie. If you're going to experience it the best, when you're not looking at the story plots and you're just drawn to how wonderful. Again, it can never be recreated now because we have a dozen more Tim Burton movies and tons of knockoffs and Michel Gondry and all these people that have continued this aesthetic. But back in 1988, there weren't a whole lot of people that were turning to the toy box as inspiration for how to be ghoulish.
And those faces don't even last that long because when they get there, we have Lydia, again, more time has passed because they left, and Lydia's ready to kill herself, and she's writing the most dramatic note she can think of, which is very teenage, I now realize.
You don't jump to your death, you plummet. I do like those little details.
And this is coming out before Heathers. This was sort of her thing. You know, she became so much for our era. She embodied like everything we would go through, all her movies. She ended up, you know, kind of taking on that persona of being the Generation X it girl. It's perfect that these are her formative films. And a little risky. I gotta say, the suits must have been a little nervous to portray the one teen character as suicidal. But it's such a joke. It's played so lightly. I don't think it would really inspire anybody.
And I get from this watching something I never got before. Again, I related to her a little too much. I may have had some dark thoughts in my teenage years. So I'm like, sure, she's a teenager, wants to kill herself. Why wouldn't any teenager want to kill themselves? But now I get from it a sweetness. She actually wants to kill herself because she likes the Maitlands so much. As foster parents to her, she likes them better than her parents. She wants to kill herself to go find them. That's a dropped line that really changes the motivation. She's no longer suicide to escape her reality. It's suicide to go find those who she lost.
Right. And again, it's why I would think she would court Beetlejuice, that she should at least toy with the idea, not always be repulsed by this zombie, ghost, whatever you want to call him.
Well, she almost does call him forth. Barbara shows up and stops her, though.
Yeah, and she will eventually bring him into the climax of the film when the Maitlands are in danger. Because Ortho is going to host Robert Goulet and Big Money New York, a sham-ish seance that will drag the Maitlands down. And I think because we saw a scene in the bureaucratic afterlife where there's a room for exercise ghosts. And we know there's a hell for ghosts where they can go and just be miserable. And they will be confined in that room if Ortho completes the ceremony.
That's what I took.
Yeah, that's how I take it. We see them, they start aging and then start falling apart. And they even say, you're killing them. They're like, you can't kill the dead. But yeah, the death for the dead is being exorcised and going to that room of lost souls.
And this is another cute effect. Even though it's supposed to be disturbing, when we see Barbara turning all gray and crackly, she ends up just looking kind of like that Edward Munch painting with the sunken cheeks.
The Scream?
Yeah.
I think dramatically, God knows, I keep going and hitting these beats and you guys are like, we don't care. But dramatically, if she had reached a point where she had gone from, I didn't want to be in this house to now I want to be in this house and it's terrible that I'm going to lose this house, we would have more affection for her. The problem is, I don't care one way or the other about Barbara and Adam. So yes, it's kind of sad that they're turning old and being vacated, but we're not really with them.
No, you are not really with them. We are with them.
Yeah, you know, I'm fine with Adam and Barbara. I don't want them to die. My problem with this climax for me is that the inclusion of Beetlejuice just seemed so slapdash. Like, hey, if you marry me, I'll save him. And where's all this stuff coming from all of a sudden? It doesn't feel organic. Where I feel most of this film, it does feel organic. And like, just, yeah, it's not a tight story, but things flow into the next scene. And here it just feels like, okay, we're at that 90-minute mark. We got to wrap it up.
And when you're a kid, you know, you just think, oh, I'll be married to someone and then trapped in that relationship. And that's forever. I don't know that as an adult you think of marriage being that kind of lock, trap, contract anymore. It's kind of like, all right, she gets married to him and then she'll cheat and go and have her own life.
I think if you're getting married properly, you do think of it that way. Otherwise, just live together. But second of all, this is a marriage to an undead person. Who knows what kind of unholy contract that brings with it?
There's not a lot at stake here. There's a lot of great ideas. There's a lot of cool visuals. But it doesn't really matter what anyone's doing.
Yeah, you're right. Because when Beetlejuice goes on the tear and is getting rid of all these people, like with Max and his wife, yeah, he does that carnival thing and they just go through the roof. We never see them again. I liked Ortho. Like, he gets put into a polyester leisure suit. That's funny.
I always like to think he killed Robert Guillet. Like...
They may have.
They were so happy when he became the carnival thing and he hit the thing. I mean, they went through a roof. I don't think the human body could survive that. I think he killed them.
It's Wile E. Coyote territory. Who knows what the rules of actual death are at any given point. The point is, it's a living cartoon. It's the same reason why people like The Mask, which also wasn't a very good movie, but people like the visuals of it.
Oof. They liked it back in, yeah, 92 or whenever it came out. What I do like about the climax here, though, yeah, it goes with that Looney Tunes thing. I like how when Adam and Barbara are trying to save Beetlejuice to get him to disappear and, like, the teeth come out and they're chasing Beetlejuice around. It's totally zany, cheap practical effects, but I love it. And, like, the zipper mouth and Gina Davis undoes the zipper to save Beetlejuice. Yeah, are these high stakes? No, but I'm entertained. I find this entertaining and it fits in this world that Tim Burton has created.
Exactly. It's a very wacky ending. The fact that he throws a zipper on her mouth, obviously she can unzip that. And then the fact that he banishes her outside to the sandworms, and I guess she is Paul Atreides now because she rides the worm back.
The Worm Whisperer. Yeah.
They needed some kind of ending. I read the script. I don't even remember how they got rid of him. They don't know what to do. It doesn't, again, what are his powers? If he does get married, what's the next step for him? What is he unleashed going to do to the world?
He says he won't be dead anymore, which seems like a step back. He seems pretty powerful.
I don't know if it means he won't be dead or if he just won't be trapped where he has to be called. Because he's currently in that Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice stage. If he gets married, he can stay out.
Yeah, I'm just not sure what the problem is if he does stay out. We kind of want him to, right? He's bringing energy to this. I like his energy with Lydia if it wasn't so pervy and illegal. You know, the goth and the extrovert, there is a marriage there somewhere, and that's where the fun of this movie lies. I do want to second you guys on all of this. As many problems as I'm having with this movie, and they are numerous, and I'm voicing them all, I do think that Tim Burton is better at this than just about anyone I can think of. This movie has been remade and redone in millions of ways. And no, Monkey Bone is a horrible film. You know, not everyone can take this aesthetic and make it fun. Usually it just looks cheap.
Is Monkey Bone to Beetlejuice what Cool World is to Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I think it's a very good comparative. And, you know, so many people would like to find that balance between, yeah, the cute and the creepy. And Tim Burton is the best at it. That's why he got the career he did. It's why he got the offers he did.
He was the best at it. It's been a while since that Burton has shown his head.
Yeah, I agree. And there have been times, many times, that he has failed or just gone into hack mode. But you can't argue with the vision. There's always the vision, and the vision is magnificent. And here in 1988... when we've only had Pee-wee's Big Adventure and might have credited all of that to Pee-wee Herman, now we can see, no, it is Tim Burton who is the visual genius.
Truthfully, he just is a maestro of this screen. Every single thing here is the aesthetic that I would associate with Burton from here on out to what I believe to now be his most popular film, Nightmare Before Christmas. I think that has become a Christmas classic for people younger than me. They praise that movie every year, but with the Elfman horn themes and the various visuals and gothic and claymation look, it's all rooted here. And here's the thing, is it doesn't feel stumbly. It's his second film, his first one in complete control, because obviously Paul Reubens exerted some control on his character. And this just fits. Every bit of it, from the wacky, it takes tonal shifts like hairpin turns, and yet it never felt jarring to me until I was watching it with the Now Playing goggles and went, whoa, okay, it's doing that. But I'd never noticed it before just as a viewer.
Right. It's because of the directing. He shows himself to uniformly give every scene the same glow. And that's a good director. Whether you like that glow or not, you can say, I don't like his style, but he is a good director in that style.
And he gives the film a good ending. I mean, we end with another Calypso number. They're living happily. And yeah, I guess Lydia is now kind of their foster daughter. You know, she has two sets of parents now, and they're all living in harmony and doing Calypso dances.
Again, if I cared more about Adam and Barbara, I could be happy they have a surrogate daughter. I think it's strange that the real parents don't want to be parents and they're just downstairs reading magazines or something. They don't know what to do because they weren't really thought out as characters. But it's an ending and it brings us back to what people love, which is, yes, Belafonte and ghost football players.
I took it that Delia would finally be a successful sculptor now that she's sculpting Beetlejuice snakeheads.
There's money in that.
And Beetlejuice gets his last scene, too, in the waiting room and the shrunken head bit.
You know, I never knew that shrunken heads were real. It was much later in life that I found out that that is not just voodoo mysticism. They do actually cut your skin off. They dry it around a rock. It shrivels in the sun. And you can have a real shrunken head. That's a real thing. But they don't normally put it back on the safari hunter's body.
Yeah, it's not a voodoo powder that you sprinkle on someone and it shrinks.
Yeah, that's the Tim Burton touch.
I also liked how Beetlejuice is hitting on the legs of the bisected woman. It always got me. So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Beetlejuice? Jacob.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious I'm going to recommend this. You know, as I was watching it this time, and look, this is rose-colored glasses, but I'm like, wow, where's all the quirky stuff today? Like, I'm sure it's out there if I sat down and looked at the movies I watched, but there's something exciting about Tim Burton when he came on the scene, like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I love that film. Then this, Batman 89 was a big film for me. Edward Scissorhands, like, you know, late 80s, 90s, Tim Burton, that is peak Burton, and it was exciting. And there's not too many directors that I get really excited about, like, where I follow every film of theirs. I mean, Wes Anderson, he's got Isle of Dogs coming out. I'm super excited for that. But rewatching Beetlejuice, every time I watch that, maybe it is that a little bit of nostalgia. It takes me place where, like, oh, here's this director that I was just excited about everything that he was doing. And this is just a wacky, zany movie. It's, you know, whenever I feel like something is outside the studio system and it's just a little too crazy, that's like there weren't a whole lot of suits watching over this film. They just kind of let this person do what they wanted to do. That's exciting to me. So yeah, this film is it a tight, taut story with lots of interesting characters? No, but it's just zany and it's all over the place and it's funny and it's quirky. And I like the different broad strokes of the square couple that turn ghosts and they're bad at haunting, and then the New York coastal elitists, and like, there's such stereotypes. But yeah, this is an entertaining film. This is a strong recommend for me.
Stuart.
It's way overrated. It is way, way overrated.
Oh, sir. Okay, now we're going to have words. You're going to throw it overrated.
It is way overrated. This movie has gotten by because it made such an imprint on us in childhood. I do not think that it is a particularly good movie. It is a great museum piece for Tim Burton, and that is enough. That is definitely enough for a recommend. I am recommending this movie, but as a film, as a story, it's a mess, and it's not that funny. It really isn't very funny at all. It is quirky. And it is visionary. And you're right. It came out at a time when nobody else was making this kind of stuff. And it just had endless ideas. You feel like this movie could be 9 hours long and you would just keep seeing more and more things.
Well, that's why they had to do a cartoon.
Yeah, you'd never see before. I'm going to argue, and I'm going to argue it without seeing it or going back to see it, the cartoon was better.
Wrong. No.
The cartoon got the relationships correct. And that I would prefer to see over a continuation of this vision. But obviously, it announces for sure, unless you wanted to credit Paul Reumans for everything, Tim Burton knew what he was doing in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, a much better film than this film.
Oh,
so much better. Like,
no.
Light years better than this film, much funnier and more joyful. And that, yeah, you would let him do anything that he wanted next, including greenlighting the biggest movie of all time about a comic book character. Egast, who would make a movie about a comic book character? No one in 1989 other than Warner Brothers. But I'm going to give it a mild recommend, guys. I'm going to fight my generation on this. It's no classic.
Oh, boy. I personally have always thought of this as Tim Burton's best film, above Batman, because I feel like Batman makes compromises and it doesn't hold up as well because it isn't as serious as it seemed in 89. And I know some people love Edward Scissorhands, and some people really love Nightmare Before Christmas, and some people even tolerate Mars Attacks.
Can I throw in that my favorite one is Ed Wood?
Yeah, that's a big cult classic favorite.
Yeah, I like Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice is where it's at for me.
Not Alice in Wonderland? You're not going to take a bold, bold stance on Alice in Wonderland and say that's his classic?
I did like Sweeney Todd. That might be the only one in the last 20 years.
Yeah, how about The Planet of the Apes? Maybe I'll say that. But here, I think everything just clicked. You had the right people involved, with the exception of, I do feel, Catherine O'Hara, Alec Baldwin, and Jeffrey Jones don't bring a lot that other people couldn't bring. But Gina Davis, I think, brings a uniqueness, definitely Winona Ryder, and then you cannot overstate how amazing Michael Keaton is in this movie that minted him as a star. You may say this movie began the decline of his career, because after this, yes, he decided he was going to be a serious actor and go do stuff like Pacific Heights, which absolutely sucked. So I think this is really hitting everything magically. The art direction, every single scene of it looks like a painting. The fact that I enjoy the Calypso music helps, but I think I'd enjoy it even if I hated Harry Belafonte. I think this is a seminal 80s movie that deserves to have a glass raised to it, and I'm happy to at its 30th anniversary. That said, the cartoon, here's what I'll say. Stuart, you might actually like it, because rewatching it, it has a little bit of a Ren and Stimpy vibe to it, and that there's two people getting into wacky adventures. I didn't like it because I even watched it when it was first run in 89. I'm like, I like Beetlejuice so much, let me try this cartoon.
It's confusing. Lydia and Beetlejuice are like BFFs in it. That's not the continuity.
They should be. That is the whole thing that needed to happen.
And her parents are pretty much gone, and the Maitlands are entirely gone from what I saw.
That's, again, all very good choices.
I can't believe Stuart's arguing for a cartoon for once.
He didn't watch it. Let's just put it out there. He's just saying he thinks it's better. The two of us who've seen it, no.
Yes.
I saw it in the day. I just haven't gone back and seen it.
Yeah, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I saw it this morning.
Okay. I don't doubt that it's, as many things from childhood are, when you go back, not as fun as when you were 10.
I'll just say, though, as much as I love this movie, I'm so glad they never made, and I never do want them to make, the sequel, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
What?
I did read a little bit about it. The idea would be that Charles still gets back into real estate development and goes to Hawaii to open up a new hotel, dragging Lydia and his wife along, not the Maitlands. Again, nobody wanted Gina and Alec to come back. And somehow, yeah, Beetle would come back and fall in love. It would be an Elvis movie. The idea was they wanted to do that 60s beach party Frankie Avalon kind of vibe. And again, that's Tim Burton's thing. He loves the 60s for its corniness, and he loves the dark gothic humor.
Yeah, the summary on Wiki says, Beetlejuice comes back from the afterlife to cause trouble and becomes a hero by winning a surf contest with magic.
All right, throw it out. No, no.
Now, that was going to be made right after Batman, but they got really involved in Batman Returns. But constantly, I think whenever Tim Burton feels like his career might need a goosing, he continues to tease that he and Keaton and maybe Winona will reunite for another Beetlejuice movie. It's been said as recently as 2016, which is one of the reasons we never covered it. We thought about throwing it in various times over Now Playing's decade, and we always were told, hey, they might make a sequel, might make a sequel. I'm praying they don't, and I don't think they will.
Yeah, I mean, they could go the way of like Ghostbusters and Ocean's 11 and Overboard and do Lady Juice.
I'd be good with that, honestly. If you're going to do it, do something new, but reboot it. Don't try to bring back Burton. Don't try to bring back Michael Keaton, who is a different man. And how can you explain to me that a ghost has aged 30 years in the afterlife?
I don't know, man. Birdman, I feel like he's tapping into a lot of Beetlejuice.
Yeah, maybe. I didn't love that movie, but I think this could be revisited with a modern eye, with a visionary new director. I just don't want to see Tim Burton go back to the well.
And so what are we going to do next? Well, it is kind of tied into the donation drive that we have going on. Starting in May, we are going to be going through the Godfather series. And when Godfather 3 came out, it sure did get a lot of criticism about how it might not have lived up to those first two films. Didn't help the fact that coming out in the same month was Goodfellas.
Oh, damn.
And so we are going to cover Scorsese's take on gangsters partnered with Godfather 3.
I have not seen Goodfellas since it came out.
How could you have not? Oh my, that's like an annual one for me.
I've been dying to rewatch it. I've needed a reason to rewatch it. I've had it on my TiVo for like 3 years. I really, really have wanted to see it again. I'm excited to revisit Ray Liotta's seminal film.
Yeah, it's arguably Scorsese's best film. I mean, there's a couple of them always in the running, but it is certainly one of my favorites.
It should have won.
Everyone knows it should have beaten Dances with Wolves, but we'll see how it does if you join us for patrons in May.
Then can we do Casino? Because that's another one I've always wanted to see and never have.
I haven't seen it and I don't want to see it.
It's not very good.
It's been on my TiVo just as long as Goodfellas on that when I have 3.5 hours to spare.
Yeah, not the same thing, though it tries.
Well, patrons, thank you for your support. It's really kind of fun to be able to do these one-off reviews for you and to just make them one-offs that we normally don't find any way to fit in the schedule. Let us know what you'd like. And in fact, you can pick a movie for us to review if you really up that patron level for a month. But even if you don't, let us know the kinds of movies you'd like us to review. Do you like 30th anniversary looks back? Do you like stuff that is kind of tangentially related to what we're doing on the main feed, like we did with The Wizard and The Last Dragon? Let us know what you'd like to hear, because we want to give it to you as our way of saying thank you. We'll talk to you next month with Goodfellas. Stuart Jacob, thank you for joining me. And now daylight come, and me wanna go home.
Signora dances calypso, left to right is the tempo. And when she gets the sensation, she go up in the air, come down in slow motion.
Well, Valens are taken care of. Everything seems to me pretty much back to normal, I think.
Well, looks like I'm next. Good thing, too. I gotta do a photo shoot for GQ in about an hour and a half.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Thank you!
Thank you! Woo!
That is why I won't do two shows a night anymore, babe. I won't do it.
Now Playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
Well, we're not even sure we want our little secret out. I mean, everyone's going to want them for the party.
People will pay big money for this, right, Grace?
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Because if I tell you, you tell your friends are calling me on the horn all the time. I gotta show up at shopping centers for openings and sign autographs and shit like that, and it makes my life a hell, okay? A living hell.
Now that you've heard this review, head to the Now Playing Podcast forums and share your thoughts on this movie. The link to our forums is at nowplayingpodcast.com.
Sure, talk amongst yourselves.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Never trust the living. We cannot have a routine haunting like yours provide proof that there is existence beyond death.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Hey, these aren't my rules. Come to think of it, I don't have any rules.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
This thing reads like stereo instructions.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2018, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Honey, I just finished the initial presentation, and now I think it's time to invite our friends to meet your friends, okay?
Are they here yet?
They're not here anymore.
I did know Gina Davis from Fletch, and she had a TV show, and...
From Fletch?
Yeah.
She was in that?
Yeah.
That's what your go-to is for Gina Davis?
Seriously, I loved her in Fletch when I was 10. I, like, crushed on Gina Davis.
She had an Oscar by the time this came out.
I didn't see that one.
It wasn't for Fletch.
I know. Well, the Oscar was for...
Accidental Tourist.
That's right, yeah.
Well, you know, that's what confused me as an 11-year-old. I thought it was going to be a slapstick Leonard Part 6. Ha-ha, that's, you know, funny. It's not
so much in that statement you just made.
I'm just trying to think of a really bad film I laughed at as a kid.
Can you imagine if Bill Cosby were in this?
Ghost Dad Part 6.
Oh.
And again, it's why I would think she would court Beetlejuice. It's why I think she should court